Well, good morning. Why are you laughing? Apparently, I am Kevin Sneed's twin. My name is Brandon Passion. I wear a sweater now, and I have a collar just like him. We even go to the same barber. It is what it is, okay? For those of you that don't know me, my name is Brandon Passion, and I'm the worship pastor here. I normally have an instrument in front of me, which turns out is kind of a comfort thing for me. So not having a guitar in front of me is a little bit scary. So when I don't know what to do with my hands, just be nice to me, okay? That's my request this morning. There's this theme that's running through Galatians about the family of God and what it means to be part of God's family. And I think it means a lot for us today, just like it did for the Galatians back then. But that got me thinking about my family. And if you were to come to a Passion family gathering, which I highly recommend you doing someday, you would discover that things are very confusing. There's a lot of people there that, you just can't figure out where they're from. And I was reminded about this when Katie started coming to our family events. We've been married now for 14 years, but when I bring my wife to family events, I'm still constantly trying to explain to people, and then I'll get to somebody and I'll be like, I actually don't know where they're from or why they're here. And I was confused by that. Actually, growing up, I didn't really understand where all of my family came from, which is kind of a weird thing, until I finally discovered where it all stemmed from and why it all happened. It all started with my favorite songwriting partner, my 86-year-old grandpa. And so 10 years ago, we started writing songs, and we were sharing, about something, and he decided to tell me the story of his upbringing. And this was a complete shock to me when he told me this a few years ago. But basically, when my grandpa was just a little guy, he was a sibling. He had two siblings, a mom, and their dad had recently died. And they were at a friend's house for the day. They were all playing, just like normal. And then his mom came up to him and said goodbye and proceeded to take his two brothers and leave. And that was the last time my grandpa ever saw his mom. And I tell you that story because I think Paul is going to go here. Paul is going to talk about what it means to be chosen. And even though he connected with his brothers 18 years later, that's about the extent of the legacy that he received. There wasn't any inheritance. There was no culture or family memories. So I think early on in those days, my grandpa made a decision as he got married and he had his own kids. There will not be any children that feel unloved in my family. There's not going to be anyone that feels like they're left behind. There's not going to be anyone that doesn't know that I chose them. And so as you look at my crazy family and all the different people, what you really see when you dig into all those different stories is you see, oh, that's from one of the marriages and the kids, and he didn't want to let those kids go. And that's from these other people. And then we have his biological brothers and their kids. And so my family's this beautiful smorgasbord of people, and I wouldn't honestly have it any other way. And I'll never know, and my grandpa actually will never know why he wasn't chosen that day to go with his mom. Almost 80 years ago, can you believe that? But I tell you that story because Paul's about to remind us what it means to be chosen, to be thought of and to be wanted. And I think at our core, if we're honest with ourselves, that's really our greatest desire, is to be chosen, to be wanted. And so I'm gonna just real quickly where I'm going with the text today. We're in Galatians chapter 4, 1 through 11, and we're gonna break this up into two different parts. Galatians 1 through 7, Paul's gonna be talking again about the usefulness of the law and also the depth of what it means to be an heir of the one true king. And then in Galatians 8 through 11, Paul warns against going back to the things that we've been freed of, including and especially the law. But ultimately, I believe this passage leads us to a greater understanding of a longing that he actually placed in us. And even though we may go, and I think we do, go lots of places to satisfy the longing that's not God, there's really only one place that will actually satisfy. So, real quickly, in the previous chapter, Paul, he was cautioning the Galatians on going back to the law, right? We remember this, hopefully. And in doing so, he was using some strong language about the law, like it puts you in slavery, and there's people that are your disciplinarians. And so when you and I think about this, when we imagine what it would be like to go back to the law, we can't even imagine it. I mean, it would be really weird for us. Animal sacrifices and a blood atonement economy and 600 plus laws to abide by. So when Paul says, don't go back to the law, we're like, yeah, I'm fine. I'm not going to go back. But you have to understand that when he's talking to the Jewish audience, what Paul was saying in chapter 3 would have actually been pretty shocking and actually probably offensive. And if you remember last week, he compared their time under Mosaic law to being held in custody and locked up and being controlled by a strict disciplinarian, and that makes sense to us. But when you look at the history of Israel, specifically when they were in slavery in Egypt, God redeemed the Jews from slavery. In fact, when God set the Jewish people free, he called them his child. And when God gave them the Torah, it began with the announcement of freedom for God's people. So when Paul is talking negatively about this thing that has set them free, it would have been a hard pill for them to swallow. But what he's trying to say and what he's trying to get them to see is, while there was an original purpose for the law, that purpose was fulfilled. I like how Kevin said it last week. He said, was the law meant to bring life? No. Was the law meant to be a teacher? No. Was it meant to transform or save? No. Its purpose, its main purpose, was to restrain evil. And it was meant to be temporary until the time the Father decided that we were ready for Jesus. And Paul reminds us here that the law had and served its purpose. But in Jesus, that purpose was fulfilled. So, in chapter 4, Paul uses a completely different illustration and one that I think maybe a lot of people could easily get on board with. And that is the concept of an heir. So if you'll look with me in your Bibles in Galatians 4, I'm going to start at verse 1, and it says this. What I'm saying is that as long as an heir is underage, he is no different from a slave. And although he owns the whole estate, the heir is subject to guardians and trustees until the time set by his father. So also when we were underage, we were in slavery under the elemental spiritual forces of the world. Now, he's talking about what it means to be an heir here, and he's basically saying that when you're underage, you're no different from a slave. Look, your daddy may own it, but you don't own it, okay? So you don't have the privileges yet, and this immediately made me think of this little article I saw about the NBA player you may have heard of, Shaquille O'Neal, and he said this, I want my kids to know that we are not rich. I am rich. I love that. And it's true. I mean, the point is well taken. I think we can all understand that even though someone is an heir, it doesn't mean their heirness has taken root yet, right? Shaq's kids likely will end up as heirs of the Shaq kingdom and all that that entails. But right now, they're limited. There are guardians and there are trustees, and they don't have the responsibility of running the estate yet, nor do they have the benefits. So he's saying this is what it's like to be under the supervision of the law. It's like a son or a daughter, who an heir that has deemed not ready by the father to manage the estate. So what he says, if you want to live in that law, this is what it was like. You have to be subject to guardians and trustees. You're supervised and you're disciplined and controlled. Specific orders will regulate and restrain your behavior. And you stay under that authority until the time set by the father. Kevin used the analogy of a babysitter last week. That when a babysitter is there to make sure that you don't destroy everything in the household and your siblings while the parents are gone. But ideally, we all get to an age, hopefully, that we don't need a babysitter anymore, right? That's what Paul is saying. He's trying to get this church plant to see that they're reverting back to a point in time in which they had no freedom. This reminds me of my daughter. I have a little girl who's 7, but a few years ago, she would come into our bed in the middle of the night. When she was little, it was kind of cute. You know, you wake up and you're like, oh, she's in our bed cuddling with us. That's so nice. And then she gets bigger. And then the thrashing happens. And then she starts kicking in her sleep right in my ribs. And then she has I don't know if it's not quite night terrors, but she talks in her sleep. And so one morning we wake up, and I say wake up lightly because we were actually just not really ever sleeping. And we just said to each other, like, something has to be done. We're being tortured here. And so We came up with a plan, and Charlie's strategy was to go on her mom's side of the bed because somehow her mom wouldn't wake up. I don't know what the deal is with that. So I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to switch spots, which, you know, if you're married, that's sacred, you know. The spot on the bed that you have, it should never change, but we changed it. And so Charlie would come in, and I'd be like, hey, it's me. And she's like, oh, and I'd take her to her bed, walk her back. And we did this for, I don't know, probably a month. And finally, she stayed in her bed. But what Paul is saying here is being under the law was kind of like being a kid. It was an important phase, right? Your childhood was important just as the law was important, but that phase is over. And we all understand that there are phases in our lives that we must outgrow. And if we choose to not outgrow these phases, we hinder not only our own freedom, but we hinder the freedom of others. In verse 3, he says, we're slavery to elemental spiritual forces. And I just this word is, I think it's kind of important. It comes up twice in this passage, so I looked it up. And it says it another time in verse 9 when he says, how is it that you're turning back to those weak and miserable forces? And the Greek word that he used is, let's see if I can get this right, stoikion. Stoikion. And it literally means an elementary or rudimentary principle of intellectual or religious system. And when Paul uses it, he's referring to this elementary nature of the law. It's elementary. It's when you were a spiritual child, you were under the law, and you were in slavery. So that's what he's saying there. So in verse 4, he says this, but when the time had fully come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law. Now, we don't have time to go into this too much, but I caught my eye, and I kept wondering with this passage, why didn't Paul just say, God sent his son to redeem those under the law? Why did he go to the trouble to say, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law? And like I said, I wish we could go into this more, but let me just at least say this. Jesus understood the law. He was born of a human woman who was also under the law. He was no stranger to it. But let that thought just blow your mind for a second. Not only did the living God who created absolutely everything come to this earth as a helpless little baby, but he also submitted himself to this law that wasn't created for him. He didn't need it. And still, in this act of true love, Jesus entered our mess in more ways than one. He grew up as a good Jew, memorizing the Torah, practicing the law. And I just want this, I think this is important. He's not a faraway God. He's a God who comes close. He's a God who gets in the middle of where we are now. So he goes on to say, to redeem those under the law, that we might receive adoption to sonship. Now, this idea of adoption is actually really crucial to Paul's message. He mentions it over 5 times in other letters to other churches. And when he talks about adoption, he's specifically talking about Roman adoption. And I think this is really fascinating when you look at the history of this, because in ancient Rome, the oldest living male in the family, called the paterfamilias, took care of and he decided everything for the family in those days, including if the child was going to be part of the family or not. So when the mother would have the baby, the midwife would put the baby on the ground, and until the paterfamilias picked up the baby, it wasn't actually part of the family. So if he decided that he didn't want the baby for whatever reason, then he would just not pick the baby up, and they would, in most cases, leave the baby out in the cold. And this is something that became pretty commonplace. It's called exposure, something that happened in ancient Rome. And side note, this is actually something that distinguished the church early on from other people, their sanctity and their value for human life, because as the Christian movement began to grow, they would pick up these babies, and they would give these babies homes. But even if you made it past being a baby, you weren't safe still. Your safety was still in the hands of the paterfamilias. If you were a kid and you made your dad mad, he had the right to disown you legally. He could also legally sell you into slavery or even end your life. That gives whole new meaning to the conversation that you have with your mom when she's like, wait till your dad gets home. You're like, oh no. But can you imagine the insecurity that you would feel as a Roman child? Like, can you imagine how vulnerable and fragile you'd feel if you make your dad mad the wrong way? He's just gonna disown you. But adoption was completely different. There were laws in Rome that protected adopted kids. And in Rome, If you're an adopted child, that meant that you were freely chosen by your parents. You were desired by them. And more importantly, that you would be a permanent part of the family. Parents could not legally disown a child that they adopted in Rome. So if you're an adopted child now, it's almost better than being a biological child. Legally, you would receive a new identity. Any prior debts or assignments would be erased, and new rights and responsibilities would be taken on. And being adopted made someone an heir to their father, joint sharers in all possessions. Now, think about that for just a minute. Think about the audience that would have been reading this, specifically the Gentile audience. Now, as they've been following this movement that Jesus started, they probably would have felt like total outsiders. They didn't have the history of the Torah and all that with God that the Jews did. And so when Paul is saying this, that you're adopted, they would have understood Roman adoption. They would have understood that they're chosen by God. And that would have been a really, really powerful message. And I think in that line of thinking, it's easy for, I know for me, I'm not Jewish, but I tend to identify with the Jews when I'm reading these things, right? If you're anything like me, you read the text as if you're God's chosen people. But in all reality, most of us in here are actually technically Gentiles. We're outsiders. And this idea that God chose us should mean something to us. That God chose to graft us into his family and that he gave us a security that we never had before. What does this actually mean? I want to pause for a second and just say this. Some of you need to hear this. God chose you. God chose you. And look at verse 6, what he says here. Because he chose you, because you are his sons, God sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts. And the Spirit calls out, Abba, Father. Paul says that God put the Spirit of his Son into your hearts, and that Spirit calls out, and that Spirit longs for your true Father. That means that all of us have a longing in our heart that has been placed there by God. And let me tell you something about this longing. I think at the core of all of our brokenness, I think at the center of everything we've done wrong is a misdirected longing, a longing that can only be found in the Father. Like, think about some of the bad choices that you've made. Think about some of the missteps that you've taken. Why did you do it? What led you there? Could it be that you brought your longing to something or someone else to satisfy other than God? And that led you down the wrong path. I have a personal story about this. And just to be fair to Kevin, I asked him to show his junior high picture. So I'll show you my junior high picture. This is little Brandon. I was super shy. That Brandon was very, very shy. I know maybe some of you have a hard time believing that. But one of the things that I just absolutely would not do is sing. My dad tried to get me to sing, but I had a twin brother, not Kevin, another twin brother, that that was glad to step into the spotlight, and he would sing for both of us. But then in sixth grade, we were reintegrated from being homeschooled for a few years back into public school, and I was so shocked by what I saw in public school. I saw these kids kissing in the hallway, and I was like, but it was clear that I didn't belong, and so I attracted some bullies, and my life instantly became pretty painful. It's safe to say that no one in school was choosing me. And then we went to a mandatory choir class, which I still had no intention of singing, but something interesting happened there. They were doing an audition, and everyone was talking about this kid, Daniel, and they're like, listen, don't even try to audition. This kid, Daniel, he's the best singer in the entire school. He's amazing. Don't even try. And I'm like, wow, I grew up in a musical family. Let's hear this. I want to hear what Daniel's got, because I know some good singers. Daniel sings, and I immediately think, I could do that. I could beat him. So I audition for the solo, and I get the solo, and what happens? All of a sudden, everybody starts talking about me, and suddenly this scared, skinny little sixth grader is being noticed, and suddenly people see me, and they choose me, and they make friends with me. Now, I tell you that sad, sad story to tell you this. Music, at that point, I think, music became one of my main sources that I went to satisfy my longing. And it took me 20 years of chasing that before I realized that the end of that road is still gonna leave me wanting more. No matter how many songs I write, no matter how many people tell me they love my music, no matter how many amazing concerts I have, Thanks, Candy. It'll never be enough. Like, there's only one place to go with that longing that you have, and it's to the Father. And it's as if Paul is screaming at the Galatians, he chose you. Do you not get that? He chose you and moved you out of that law, not at random, but because he had to, but because God sent his son to redeem everyone enslaved by the law so that you could be a part of his family. Because you were chosen, you have a new legacy. Your slavehood is no more. Because you were chosen to be his son or a daughter, you have a new identity. You have a new family. You have a new purpose. And Paul is saying, don't ignore that longing. Don't ignore that voice inside of you that I put there. God said, you're his child. So please don't ignore who God says you are. Look, if you're running from God or you're looking for hope or your happiness or joy in something other than God, you know there's a longing that never goes away. You feel it. There's an ache that's never satisfied deep in your bones. Tim Keller said it this way, no one can live without meaning, satisfaction, freedom, identity, forgiveness, given or received, moral resolutions, and hope for the future. This culture's way to provide these things will ultimately not work. And I think when we're running from God, we feel that. It's just not working. But on the other hand, when we connect with him, there's a fullness, right? There's a satisfaction. I felt it when we were singing, I'm a child of God. Yes, I am. That's unlike anything this world has to offer, and it's because you were designed for it. And Paul, he understands this story better than anyone. Like, Paul was chosen in about as dramatic a way as anyone in the history of mankind, right? The road to Damascus. So in verse 8, Paul reminds them of their own slavery. He reminds them that there was a time that they didn't have a choice to be free. So look in verse 8. He said, formerly, when you did not know God, you were slaves to those by whose nature are not God's. But now that you know God, I love this, or rather are known by God, how is it that you are turning back to those weak and miserable forces? Do you wish to be enslaved to them all over again? This by whose nature are not God's were the objects of the pagan Gentiles worship. That's what Paul is referring to here. And they may have been stone or wood idols, or they may have been mythical beings, or they may have been demonic spirits. We really don't totally know, but whatever they were, Paul says, they're not the divine. Whatever you were worshiped before, it's not God. They don't have the attributes of God. They're finite, they're created things. And God is infinite, and God is creator. So Paul said, when we turn back to our idols, we're enslaved by them. He says it another way, in Romans 6:16, he says, don't you know that when you offer yourselves to someone as obedient slaves, you're slaves of the one you obey? Whether you're slaves to sin, which leads to death, or to obedience, which leads to righteousness. He says both ways are slavery. One leads to death, and one leads to life. Another way to say it is a question that we came up with, which is, who are you offering yourself to? Paul is speaking to both the Jews and the Gentiles here, and he's speaking to all of us. If you're like the former Gentiles and you're worshiping idols, you're worshiping something that is not God, and you're in slavery to sin. And if you're going back to the law and obeying the law that declared is no longer necessary, you are not worshiping God, you're worshiping the law. And you're trying to satisfy that longing in something that was never created to satisfy. So he says to them, are you really going back to that elementary stuff? Are you really going to go back to the stuff you don't need anymore, the stuff that will leave you empty? Are you really going to go backwards? Are you really going to go back to sleeping in your parents' bed? Because that'd be awkward. This has got to be one of the most frustrating parts of being God, right? And it certainly was frustrating for Paul. He goes on to say, you're observing special days and months and seasons and years. And at first glance, when I was looking at this, it looked like he was just referring to Jewish holidays and observances, but the Jewish calendar actually didn't actually look at the seasons. Jewish timekeeping actually referred to festivals, not seasons. So this season idea actually came from a pagan Celtic tradition. So Paul is again referring them back to their stoicheion, or elementary spiritual laws, again with the Mosaic law, but also this time referring to the pagan traditions and religious rituals of the Gentiles before they knew Jesus. Now, I want you to remember one of the purposes of this letter, maybe the purpose, that returning to the law is not just negatively impacting the Jews in Galatia. right? It's having a profound impact on the Gentiles as well. And that's what he's addressing here. Even though we saw in earlier chapters that the majority of the believers in Galatia are not yet circumcised, they're giving Paul every indication that they're about to take this step, that they're about to do this irreversible but unnecessary step to try to somehow please God. Is Paul frustrated they're going backwards? Yeah. He's frustrated that the Jews are living enslaved to a law that is no longer necessary. But he's also frustrated because the Jews going back to the law isn't just hurting the Jews, not just putting them in slavery, but they're also risking putting new believers in bondage as well. And I've been here before. I've had people that I know that are maybe baby Christians, and they're super open to this idea, and they love Jesus, and they want to follow him, but then they've been exposed to something that actually wasn't from God at all. And I can't tell you how many times I've had to say, that hatred that you just heard, that's not my God. That exclusion that you just experienced, that's not my faith. That legalism is what my Jesus actually came to get rid of. And I find myself wanting to protect those new in the faith sometimes, just like I think what Paul is doing here, like the Gentile Galatians. And I want to protect them from maybe well-meaning Christians, but Christians who are adding extra things to the gospel of Christ. So I get his frustration when he says this last, I fear somehow I have wasted my efforts on you. So I want to summarize this just briefly. Paul compares Christian Jews returning to the law as an adult heir for who some reason turns back to being a child, reverting back to no power, no authority, or no freedom. He also reminds us of the power of what it means to be chosen by God. He reminds us of the grace and the privilege of being God's children. He tells us that God installed a longing in each inside of us. And then he warns us that returning back to the law will not only enslave us, but enslave others who are attempting to follow Jesus. So what does it mean for us? How does this do we even still wrestle with this today? Is this even something, or is this something that was dealt with a long time ago? Like, in what ways are we as a society or us as individuals going backwards into our former slavery? Who are we actually obeying? Who are we actually offering ourselves to? I was talking to a friend of mine who was raised in a pretty legalistic tradition. And in that tradition, there were very specific ways that she could earn favor with God. And as we talked, and even though she's left that tradition and she understands the grace of God and his love and his salvation, she admitted to me that there's kind of a comfort in that old way for her. That there's kind of a comfort in knowing that there's a certain right way to live. And if you mess up, you can just, you know, pray a certain thing or do certain things and just make up for it in a tangible way, and that will immediately get rid of your guilt. And this is just my opinion, but I think the law actually appeals most to our need for control. There's something comforting to our flesh about being able to control our behavior or control our atonement. You may not want Mosaic law, but you probably don't want to sacrifice an animal when you sin. I hope not. That'd make church messy. But perhaps there are other ways in which you try to earn favor with God. You may not have wooden sculptures, but perhaps there are other ways in which you serve and worship things that are created instead of the Creator. And we know this. We all struggle with our idols. We all have false narratives that put us on path to destruction. And the thing about idols is this, that they always overpromise and underdeliver. Like, if we can just save enough money, we'll feel secure and stress-free. Has that ever worked out for anybody? If I can just perform well enough at my job, I'll finally find the respect and value I need. If I could just lose enough weight, I know I'll be happier and people will like me more. And the brokenness doesn't stop with us. We put it on our kids. If my children can just get good enough grades, I can put them in the right college and they can make enough money, so then they'll be happy. If only I could... If only she could. And then suddenly we're locked into something that was never meant to bring life in the first place. No idol will ever satisfy your longing. And here's the real tragedy of returning to the law. Using Paul's analogy, it's not just that we miss out on the benefits of being an heir of God. It's really easy to focus on the benefits of being an heir of God. There are definitely massive benefits, but it's the tragedy is that we're so busy following the wrong path that we lose sight of the responsibility of what it means to be heirs to the king. See, God's design when he gave us the keys to his kingdom is that we bear his image everywhere we go. That wherever we go, we point to the true desire of our hearts. That we show people that what they're really looking for is the Father. See, the tragedy of my music career is that actually God did create me for music. I can see that now, and hopefully you guys can see that too. They're like, no, man, change it up. Stop. But when I look at the years of white-knuckling a music career apart from God, I don't see shame, but I do see years of wasted opportunity. In the last years, I've attempted to submit this gift he gave back to me, and I've seen movement like I've never seen before. I've written and published my first song. I've seen a worship ministry thrive. I've walked side by side with broken musicians that look a lot like me. I've reoriented my calendar to reflect his priorities instead of whatever gig I'm doing. And while I am doing fewer shows, the ones I'm doing have purpose beyond just bringing glory to the name of Brandon Passion. And this is the grace that we experience apart from the law. What God wanted from me was the musician he created submitted to him. Now, can you imagine what the Bay would look like if we all started submitting ourselves to being image bearers of God? That was his design. Software engineers going to work, writing code and software and whatever else you do in Jesus' name. Event planners that work with their clients in a way that glorifies God and they start to notice what's different about this. Teachers that are deeply rooted in Jesus and the Word who will care about their students the way Jesus cares about us. CEOs and CFOs and COOs in the Bay who love Jesus, who are submitted to his kingdom, running the most influential companies in the world. Can you imagine for a second what that would do to our Bay Area? The farm that my grandpa was left at was owned by a sweet Filipino man named Benny Passion. He was a loose acquaintance of my grandpa's mom, and he didn't know much about my grandpa's mom other than that she struggled to put food on the table. And Benny liked Vince, and he thought he was a good boy, so he let him stay. Benny eventually married, and he had two more kids, but Vince was part of the family now. Benny died the same week I was born, and so I never really got to meet him, but when my grandpa talks about him still to this day, there's this glimmer in his eye. Because in all of the questions and in all of the hurt and abandonment and pain, there was someone who chose him. Someone who gave him a legacy and gave him a name. And when we get together, a sort of rite of passage is this gold bracelet that I'm wearing today. It's not the most trendy jewelry in the world, but we all wear it with pride, the Passions. And Dale said this when he left last week. He said, you need to remember who you are. And that starts with remembering whose you are. I hope you'll hear this morning, church, that when you were chosen by God by the foundations of the earth, that the psalmist says that he knit you together in your mother's womb, and he chose you for a purpose, to bring his light into every single place you go. We're going to worship now, and we're going to declare some of these truths that we just learned, that we're no longer slaves to fear. We're actually his children. And I hope that this will dive into your soul just a little bit deeper this morning. So let's stand as we close and worship together.